I'm Hugh Atchison, and this is Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot. On today's show, I visit former Top Chef winner, extraordinary human, wonderful restaurateur and chef, and a dear personal friend. That's Brooke Williamson. And Brooke and I spoke in Playa del Rey, where she lives, where she has businesses, which is a tiny neighborhood in Los Angeles, right between Santa Monica and Manhattan Beach. A tiny little beautiful neighborhood right on the beach. LAX is right next door. It's really convenient. We met and we talked about her restaurant, the main one, which is called Playa Provisions, where we were, and talked about the other restaurants they have. And Playa Provisions is basically four restaurants within itself. It's got fine dining, it's got more lunch and breakfast service area, and it's got a whiskey bar, and it's got an ice cream shop. And we set up in the whiskey bar because it wasn't open yet. But Playa Provisions is ambitious, and it's multidimensional and fun, much like Brooke. And it was just great to sit down there and catch up. I have two other conversations upcoming that I taped in Los Angeles when I was there recently. James Beard West winner Michael Cimarusti, who's the chef and co-owner of Providence and Connie and Ted's, and James Beard outstanding chef winner Suzanne Goyne, who owns Luke's, AOC, and Tavern Restaurant. But here's this week's conversation. Brooke Williamson takes Los Angeles. Where the hell are we?
Playa del Rey.
Playa del Rey.
Have you heard of it?
That's in California. It's part of the greater Los Angeles area. And the person who's geographically telling me where we are is Brooke Williamson. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Hugh.
So Brooke is a very amazingly established chef in the LA scene and has been here. You grew up here, didn't you?
Los Angeles? Yeah. Not Playa del Rey, but yes.
Well, yeah. Los Angeles is like a country. So where'd you grow up?
Kind of on the west side, Brentwood, West Hollywood, but always the greater Los Angeles area.
Were you a 90210? That zip code?
I was briefly. Okay. I only know it in my area code history, but yeah, as an adult, I've lived in West Hollywood, Venice, Mar Vista. Currently live in Westchester, which is 5 minutes from the airport.
Not the Westchester, as in on the East Coast, where the rich people live, where
not
the private airport is.
Very different. Okay.
And Brooke, many people know from Top Chef, from a number of iterations of Top Chef being on there in a couple of different seasons. She's a Top Chef winner. But more importantly, she is an amazing chef who runs Playa Provisions, the triple, Da Kiko Kiko. You have to say it quickly or slowly.
Da Kiko Kiko.
A Hawaiian food concept in Playa Vista. And then Hudson House. So four restaurants.
Oh, there's an ice cream shop too.
And there's an ice cream shop too. And we're at Playa Provisions. We're in the back of Playa Provisions in a little whiskey bar called Grain that's not open right now. So we have the run of the place. Well, I'm not going to do that because it's early. Brooke, you know, when we talk about terminology and chefdom, you are self-taught. First of all, tell me what that means, and then I'll tell you what it means to me.
To me, that's not really a thing.
I totally agree.
You know, people say that all the time because I didn't go to culinary school. I think that's a default term. I was taught by many chefs, yes, but mostly my colleagues who took it upon themselves to show me the time of day in the kitchen and teach me what they felt like was important for me to learn.
But you started doing this when you were really young. I mean, you know, I always considered self-taught being I was taught by a number of great chefs over the years, learned a lot from bad chefs of what not to do.
Just as much, yeah.
And while getting paid for it. Mm-hmm. So it's different from cooking school in a lot of ways, obviously, but it gives us a different perspective. But you started when you were cooking when you were 15?
I mean, professionally, 17.
Yeah.
I did apply to CIA. My plan was to go to culinary school. And then I got a job to do my restaurant hours that were required of me to get into school and ended up not leaving. And one, because I felt like I was doing what I wanted to be doing already and getting paid for it and not spending a fortune. And two, because I was working for Ken Frank at the time, who was a pretty notable chef who told me not to go to culinary school.
Which restaurant?
Phoenix at the Argyle Hotel.
Phoenix, that's F-E-N-I-X, wasn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Yes.
So Phoenix at the Argyle Hotel. Ken Frank is best known for La Toque in Napa, probably.
Well, he opened La Toque.
He's an amazingly successful California chef.
He opened La Toque in Hollywood in the 70s.
Okay, and then moved it.
And then did a bunch of stuff in between, and then ended up reopening La Toque in Napa. And okay. when he left Los Angeles to open La Toque in Napa, he actually asked me to come with him, and I was 18 at the time and didn't feel like my life belonged in Napa, so I didn't go.
Yeah, I think everybody's life belongs in Napa, but probably I'm more of a Sonoma human, but that's okay.
I wasn't sure that I could handle it at that age.
Well, yeah.
I was still into going to bars after work and had my whole life here, and I just wasn't ready for that step.
So from Phoenix, you go to Michael's? Is that pretty
from
much the
Phoenix,
right?
From Phoenix, when Ken left, I went to Michael's.
And Michael's is Michael McCarty's restaurant, and explain Michael's for those who don't know it.
I mean, it was one of the defining restaurants of California cuisine, quote unquote.
And the number of chefs who've come out of Michael's and gone on to fame is pretty amazing. Wasn't Jonathan Waxman?
Jonathan Waxman was one of the opening chefs.
Yeah.
Mark Peel, Nancy Silverton. I mean, I could go on. There's a lot. We just celebrated the 40th anniversary of Michael's restaurant. It was with a big party in his backyard. I did a station. He invited some previous chefs to come.
What'd you make?
Work. I made shrimp chips with shrimp salad on it. It was just like a little station. And I didn't want to overextend myself in that circumstance.
Well, that's
so
a good
I
idea.
Did something that I felt like I could handle on my own.
I think over the years we've all realized that when we have to go to events and cook for 600, that you make it really good, but make it relatively
super,
easy.
Super simple. I also didn't have any help that day, so I
well, that's
sure.
half of the time when we do these yeah. things. But the worst thing is watching an overly ambitious young chef try and do something way too complicated at an event and just kind of fall in their face
yeah.
doing it because
and
it's
why
just,
do it then you yeah, can enjoy yourself and I mean
trying to prove something to
no,
themselves
I don't feel like I need to do
no,
that
I know. God, I feel so old. I just have to prove to myself that I need a nap. I like that much better. And then you were at tell me about Zach's. It was a restaurant you were in when you were younger. This is before you're owning your own restaurant, which yeah, I mean, you opened up Hudson House I think first when you were 24, but this is now before
this
that.
This was before that, yeah. This was my second executive chef position at the age of 22, which is horrifying. And Zach's was an incredible experience. It taught me that I was kind of capable, what I was capable of at that time. It also left me with unlimited creativity. I ran my own kitchen. I was really young, and I kind of was just sort of figuring out how to run a kitchen and be creative at the same time. I was also 22, and that's all I had to worry about, you know, was work. So
I always found when I was really young and in kitchens and in charge, I really only think about it in retrospect, though, but most of the people I was having to lead every day were way older than me.
Yeah.
I mean, was that... Was
I didn't
that
even really
conscious?
Think. No, it I th- wasn't.
Yeah,
I didn't think about it. It was about expertise and how I could lead based on knowledge and experience rather than age.
Yeah, so. I think that basically, like, the age is based more on your ability than your physical age at that point.
Yeah, I think I had worked very hard for a good 4 or 5 years, and no, I didn't deserve to be an executive chef at 22. In retrospect, I think I did a great job with what I had in me, but I still had so much to learn. And then when I ended up opening my own restaurant, my now husband and I opened a restaurant when we were 24, 23. I think he was 24, I was 23. And we had no idea what we were doing. You know, I didn't, and had never had to worry about the finances of a restaurant or licenses. And we made a lot of, I call that my my culinary school. The most expensive culinary school that one could go to is opening a restaurant.
Your first restaurant and having it fail and piling money into it to try and keep it stable.
For a year, we were having major liquor license issues. Issues that we could have avoided had we done the research that I didn't know to do.
I think that's really important, though, for young chefs to realize the difference between being a chef and working for other people and being a chef owner. That it's not just another word after chef. I mean, it is.
It's a different job.
It's a pile of accounting and then cleaning the restrooms every morning because you have to.
Yeah.
And you can't afford to have somebody else do it.
Yeah.
So what was the first restaurant called?
Amuse Cafe.
Amuse Cafe.
Like amuse.
Oh, yes. Okay. Where was it? We were young and easily amused.
It was in Venice at the base of Abbott Kinney, where Abbott Kinney hits Main Street, before Abbott Kinney was Abbott Kinney.
And Abbott Kinney is now really Abbott Kinney.
It's very Abbott Kinney.
The street of, Jeremy Fox is there, and Felix is there, isn't it?
Felix is there, yeah. We just went to MTN, or Mountain, however you want to pronounce it, which is the Jelena guys have that place, which is really good.
Jelena and Justa. I guess, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's talk about what you view as the change in the LA food scene in the, 20-odd years that you've been doing this.
Dramatic.
It really is dramatic.
Really
mostly in the
dramatic.
Last 5 years.
Five years. When I was starting out in this business, I kind of figured that I wouldn't end up in LA because LA wasn't a serious food city. There were a few sort of notable, recognizable restaurants that people knew about across the country, but just a few. And I felt like in my early career, the only way to sort of get a leg up on the Angelinos aspiring to cook was to go somewhere else. So I went to New York, I staged at Danielle, and eventually I figured I'd either end up in San Francisco or New York. But LA wasn't serious at all, and now you can find anything you want here. And of some really interesting,
and some
serious,
things that you can't find
wonderful.
Anywhere else.
Yeah, you can. Yeah, I mean, you name it, it's here.
Is the proximity of Playa Provisions in your restaurants to the beach, which is in view, is that help with buying seafood? And
no. I mean, we don't buy seafood out of this ocean.
You know, no. It's a really big ocean, Brooke. Please tell me it's some of it's edible.
I mean,
not
here
right
at Dockweiler Beach. No.
Yeah. Not.
Although my husband and my son go fishing out of the marina here, they go.
Do they have superpowers now from eating that fish?
I mean, they fish. I don't like boats, so that's their thing together. And they come home and they bring home like rockfish and. There is some decent edible stuff out there, but you kind of have to go a ways out.
You have to go a ways out for safety reasons.
Which is why I don't go.
So, okay, let's talk about, this is May. What are you excited about at farmers markets? What are you excited about in the California scene that comes about every year this time of year? Whether it's vegetables or fruits or meats or fish or what's a seasonal thing that's really exciting to you right now?
I think about seasonality in vegetables and fruits.
Yep.
So I've actually, over the last couple of years, gotten really into gardening. And that has really spawned some produce excitement in my life. And it's sort of this little baby experiment in my front and backyard that shows me what is really thriving at that very moment. Because I can go to the farmers markets, which I've done my whole life. I go to the Santa Monica Farmers Market on Wednesdays to pick up stuff from people who really know how to grow stuff. But I can also walk outside and see, what is starting to look beautiful at my own house, which is kind of a fun little experimental thing. So the artichokes are starting to look really good, which are my favorite vegetable to eat, probably my least favorite to cook.
That is so weird, because down on my list of things, I was like, I wanted you to talk through to me, like, how would you cook something? And I wrote artichoke. So tell me how you cook. Tell me, not a chefy recipe, just tell me the basics of what you would do at home with an artichoke. And is the globe artichoke or a baby artichoke?
I go with globe because I feel like it's the biggest bang for the buck in terms of prep time.
There's more heart to
there's
it.
There's more heart, and that's, you know, that's the gold. And I do what my mom did. She always boiled them. So
whole,
I trim them
whole.
Yeah. Trim them, clean them, cut off, you know, the top, and then boil them in some salted lemon water, and then pull them out, let them dry off, cut out the choke, and dip them in some butter
melted
and lemon
butter.
Juice. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the classic California thing. I was when my dad, we lived here when I was, my dad was teaching at Stanford on the sabbatical when I was like two. And I remember 2 to 4 eating artichokes exactly like that with drawn butter,
yeah,
simply boiled, and you pulling off the leaves. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of this epic long meal. But it's also
it's a
like
journey to get to the heart.
It's also like this, it's a fucking thistle, you know, it's this evil vegetable that's got this amazing innards to it.
Yeah. And it's so specific, and like the flavor of an artichoke is so specific. It doesn't taste like anything else to me.
No, it's got almost like a really engaging metallic-y flavor, mm-hmm. that, but that's good in a good way. Yeah, they're so interesting, but they're so fucking bitter if they're raw.
Yeah, I mean, I do love a good shaved raw baby artichoke.
Yeah, babies are good. Globes are just too much.
Yeah.
But artichokes around here, I mean, artichokes, what's the artichoke capital of the world? Gilroy's for garlic.
Yeah,
and it's right
north.
Next to Gilroy. What's it called?
It's Castroville
artichokes. Yeah. Uh-huh. But yeah, drive on that highway and they're like
everywhere.
20 artichokes for $1.
That's amazing.
And then you go to Whole Foods and it's like $4.99 for one. And you're like, that sucks, America.
I know. I have 17 of them growing at home right now. And I'm just so excited to save that money.
And you're like, wow, this is my savings right now because I run restaurants. We have no savings. This is awesome. I guess we'll touch on Top Chef, though. I don't really care to talk about too much about Top Chef. I mean,
that's how we met.
I know it is how we met. But you know, the interesting thing, I said no to regular Top Chef for years, and I said yes to Masters because I felt like it wouldn't, like if I was deemed a jackass on it, it wouldn't sully my reputation on Top Chef Masters because it's for charity. So you can always shrug and go, it doesn't matter.
And you're already qualified as a master.
And you're
from the
qualified
moment you
as a master. Yeah. So, yeah, which I don't know what the testing or designation for that is, but I'll take it.
I always wondered, how do you define who belongs on Masters?
No idea. I guess I said no so many times on Top Chef Regular. They were like, he must be a Jedi Master.
Strange, because I said no a few times, too. They didn't deem me
anything.
So
why'd you say yes in the end, then?
I don't know. I think it was the fourth or so time that they approached me. And I think with women, it's a little bit different because they kind of go, I think there's a smaller pool of talent to choose from.
It's growing exponentially.
But I mean, this was 8-9 years ago when I first, no more than that. Oh my God.
Yeah. I always feel like they cast in this with a keen attention to gender to make sure there's parity involved.
Yeah. So there has
to be. Then halfway through or near the end, gender goes out the window. It doesn't matter at some point.
Right.
It's like, it really comes down to, who's the better chef involved. So it's one of the, it's in that way, I'll give them a good thumbs up and a lot of kudos for not letting that become an issue. Like it's just not, but it is very much so in the casting, I think, at the beginning.
Sure. Because I think it has to be, because I think that the people who apply and go to the auditions or whatever they are, casting calls, are probably predominantly men.
Yeah, I would think
maybe
so.
Maybe not anymore.
Yeah.
But at least when I first started getting asked, which was 10 or 11 years ago, and I had just opened Hudson House, or I was about to open Hudson House, and then I just opened the Triple, and then I was pregnant, and then, or no, I don't know about the timeline of all this, but eventually I decided, I kind of had seen a few seasons of and what it could do for people's careers. And I think that I had a 4-year-old at the time, and his livelihood is the most important thing in my life. And I've already kind
of... Well, he's really cute, too, so that helps.
Sweet. He was really cute at
He was really cute when he was young, yeah. He's still really
he's
cute.
He's still really cute. But, you know, I felt like I had to be a responsible human being. And part of that was to do things out of my comfort zone.
And to put my head on the chopping block of reality television.
It didn't, you know, it that was actually not at all... I don't know how to explain it. I didn't look at Top Chef as a reality TV show. I looked at it as an opportunity to
show your skills.
Yeah, and to bring bring attention to my restaurants that was virtually impossible to do any other way.
And that's probably a really good argument for being on it. I mean, to me, somebody once said, you know, a cookbook is a bigger business card than you have. Mm-hmm. And TV is an even bigger business card. So you just get, it opens doors and it opens opportunities and lets your restaurant get recognized in a larger field to hopefully be successful. I mean, we're in a really small margin business, so any angle we can to
exactly
hype up our places
to
is
make
probably
life
a
little
thing.
Easier
hopefully,
you know?
or harder, who knows.
Depends on how you look
world.
At it.
Yeah.
But Top Chef did give this sort of potential to expand what I knew I always wanted for my entire life, and that, you know, my number one focus was always my restaurants.
So what season were you first on?
10 in Seattle.
Seattle, that's right. Okay. Who won that year?
Kristen Kish.
Jesus.
That was a rough finale for me.
That was a rough finale. Oh, wait. Was that the live one?
Yes.
Oh, that was... Oh.
Yeah. I got some really splendid comments from you. That was good.
That'll
stick with me forever.
Yeah. That was the strangest finale. And the idea... I have no idea who at Bravo was like, this is going to go seamlessly.
No, nobody ever felt that way again.
No, they never did it again, I don't think. No. Yeah, that was really interesting. The truck went down, broke down. The audience.
Audio went out for an hour.
They kept playing the sort of installed audience with more booze.
It was so
then
hot.
They ran out of booze. It was hot.
Yeah.
The audience was all cranky.
My poor kid was there sleeping at the table.
Oh, yeah. And I think, yeah, everybody. He had lost interest, then it came back and it went back on and got going again. Oh, that was crazy.
Yeah.
And so you lose in that one, but mm-hmm. then in the new sort of
mm-hmm.
idea of Top Chef is they find people they really like who came close and they invite them back again to come into the
like
gladiator
the
realm.
The drama's good.
I know, it is dramatic. And so, was that next season?
No, 14. It was 4
14,
years later.
14, it was 4 years later. Jeez,
yeah.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
So where was 14?
Charleston.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah, with the finale in Mexico.
And where was that in Mexico? It was San Miguel de Allende.
Well, yeah.
Oh, but then, no.
Miami
that was,
Riviera.
Yeah,
basically.
That's right.
Oh,
that's
it started in Guadalajara.
In Guadalajara, okay.
And
okay.
then we ended
and
up.
And then you won.
I did.
You won.
Yeah,
who'd
that
you
was
beat?
Fun. Shirley Chung.
Who had also been on before.
Yes. 2 years earlier, I think.
She was at Texas, I think. No, I don't know. Whatever.
New Orleans?
Yeah, New Orleans. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Right. That's crazy. And so after all these people that you've met on Top Chef, who do you really still hang out with, communicate with? Because I know you actually communicate with a fair number of them.
I do. I consider several of them actual, like, dear friends.
Yeah.
I'm still very close with Kristen. I am still very close with Casey Thompson.
Yep.
Shirley and I are close. We live in the same city, see each other all the time. I would say from the first season, I mean, I'm still pretty close with most of the people from season 14. From the first season that I was on, which was several years ago, the people who I would still consider like to be true friends of mine would be CJ and
mm-hmm.
and Kristen probably are the two that I keep in touch with the most.
Yeah. So what are the new challenges after all that with opening, having restaurants and having a family and being a working chef still? What are the new challenges that are different than they were 5 years ago?
It's just more
numbers.
I mean, numbers never really feel like more or less to me, because, I mean, the restaurant still functions the way it does.
Right.
So, but I would say the amount that I travel, the amount that I am not at my restaurants. However, having a certain number of restaurants kind of already takes me out of that that equation of being at one restaurant a whole lot. I think just my responsibilities are vast.
Yeah, I mean, I think
I'm spread out. I'm on a computer a lot.
I find myself saying no to more and more things, and I think that's really liberating in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I think I've gotten to a point where now I weigh the positives and the negatives of being taken out of my daily routine to go somewhere just to go somewhere. I am fortunate enough to be able to be in a position to say no to stuff that that a lot of people would love to be doing. However,
right. But we've done it. You've been through it in some ways.
You know, there is something to be said for how your life suffers when you leave it for 4 days to go eat and drink and be social and work. And, I'm missing my son. Yeah. I'm missing my family. I'm missing my workouts. I'm missing my routine, which
connects with your people and your businesses, and you're missing regularity that I think we crave in life after a certain time in our lives.
Yeah.
But we want that. We want that foundation to be there. That's important. I think being successful in chefdom begets you many, many opportunities. It definitely does not mean that you have to say yes to every single one of them.
Right.
Because, you'll become like some of the people out there who look really tired at the airport.
And I've been that person.
I know.
For years. And now I have to say to myself, is what I'm going to get out of this worth doing it?
Yeah.
And sometimes it is. Sometimes it's, a great trip to Hawaii. And
which we did recently, and it was awesome.
It was awesome.
Yeah, and those are good. But it has to make time sense and economic sense to be a chef these days. Again, we're at Playa Provisions, but this restaurant's really interesting. It seems to play a lot of functions. It seems to be a magnetic hub for the community.
Yes. We're very neighborhood focused.
Rich people fighting erosion? That's what I saw driving in.
Some, yes. And the houses have these phenomenal views of the ocean. However, there are people who have lived here for 50 years.
Right.
Who, bought these houses before they were worth what they are now. And so our demographic and our clientele is very across the board, very different. We have families that come in for brunch, like right now, the patio and dining room and dockside, which is the seafood sort of more formal sit down area, we're busy for brunch. It's a holiday weekend. But still, brunch is kind of our Saturday, Sunday bread and butter. And then we will be open all day, the cafe, grab and go stuff for people going down to the beach, although the weather's crappy today. But and then we have this doggy patio where we allow dogs, so a lot of people grab stuff and sit in there, very casual, coffee, pastries, and then
dog treats.
We don't make dog treats. We have made dog treats. We don't currently.
I think that's I think it's a pretty obvious choice. I think you should probably be investing in that.
We're lacking a little bit in the dog treat department. I'll try to.
I used to eat dog biscuits when I was really young.
That's interesting.
We had dogs. Yeah.
Okay.
Good teeth. I have good teeth.
Oh. Okay.
Because of it.
All right.
They're good for your teeth.
Anyway, and then the whiskey bar opens at 6, and then we'll start to get busy maybe around 7 or 8, sometimes right off the bat, depending on how busy the main dining room opens an hour earlier. So depending on how quickly that fills up, sometimes people feel like they just want a quieter, more casual atmosphere, and they'll come into the whiskey bar.
Do you serve food at Grain?
So yeah, and it's a completely different menu.
All working out of one kitchen?
Yeah. Yeah, so the cafe is one menu, the brunch menu, and then the dockside dinner menu are its own menus, and then we have the Grain whiskey bar menu, which is very kind of focused on food that goes with whiskey and sort of darker libations.
So what goes, I mean, I always think like tears go well with whiskey, you know.
I mean, I'm thinking more like scotch eggs.
Country music, Irish music.
We've played country not often.
Sadness.
No, we try to keep the mood level on the upswing in this room. Oh. And I think it generally, it works out. And I think that most of the people that come here are happy.
Okay. Maybe I'm just projecting.
but, you know, I think that's very dependent on our cocktail list.
Right, being, right. No, that's good. I think
being a happy list.
There's a happy side to whiskey, too.
So, and the cocktail lists are completely different depending on which bar you're at. So the main bar is very sort of fresh, makes you feel like you're on the coast at a beach community, you know, fruit forward, citrus forward cocktails, whereas in here it sort of feels more like prohibition style cocktails.
Okay. And whenever we're asked certain questions as chefs, I'm always repellent of them, but I find this question very difficult to answer.
What's your favorite dish to cook?
No. That's the worst. The worst questions you can ever ask a chef are, what's your favorite food to cook? And second is, what would you eat for your last meal? Mm. Which my answer is always, how am I about to die? Because I may just want a smoothie.
Scenario. Oh, okay.
You know, I don't know how I'm going.
Okay.
No, how would you define your food overall? What are you trying to say when you're cooking overall? What's the fucking point, Brooke?
I have so many points. So every one of my restaurants has a completely different menu.
But there's still a common thread and a backbone to it.
And I think that the only way that is recognizable is by potentially the ingredients and the style in which I cook them. You know, I am a California girl. I did grow up in Los Angeles. I worked at Michael's. I feel like my early career and education in produce and simplicity of how to treat it sort of is the underlining carry through between all of the restaurants.
So you're making smoked salmon pizza and avocado toast? Is that what you're saying, Brooke?
I'm not Wolfgang Puck. However, I do appreciate a good avocado.
I like, and that smoked salmon pizza at Spago is pretty sensational. I gotta say, yeah. 30 or 40 years later or whatever it is.
I 100% agree. However, no, I think that the versatility in the produce and the respect for seasonality is kind of what maybe you might feel like is me.
Yeah.
Throughout, you know, because I have some Asian food, I have some Hawaiian food, I have some.
Yeah, but to me, you're an American cook, and yes, very but much so. But in the modern sense of being an American cook, you're recognizing that America's influenced and. You know, it's a potpourri of different cultures, and you're representing them, and which is very California, it's very LA.
Yeah.
So, which is a good thing.
But makes it virtually impossible to define what style of cuisine.
Well, it's easier than the "what's your favorite food to cook" thing. I'm always like, a salad? Is that even cooking? I don't know.
That's what I made on my audition to get me onto Top Chef.
You made a salad
for you.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
The first episode that I was ever on. God,
where was that? That was that horrible restaurant. I don't even think it's
but
around.
But it was supposed to be your restaurant.
Oh, I know. But, it was a shit show back there. It was so.
Yeah. Wang's, Santa Monica. What was it called? It was like a bar. Something Wang's.
I forget what it was. Yeah.
But no, I made a salad, and everybody's like,
"Really? Oh, I remember now. Yeah.
You made a salad,
yeah.
Really?"
It's funny. Everybody's always asking me, like, "What's your favorite meal that you ever ate on Top Chef?" And I'm like, "I can't remember
any of it.
I can't remember any of it. I did it, and I finished each episode, and I was like, the men in black people were like, zap my head, but I think a lot of those people are on that show the same way. It's just like, I don't know, but it's good. It's cool. So what's next? Not today. I mean, like, what's the arc? What do you want to do? I mean, do you want to keep doing this? Do you want to burn it all down and become a dental hygienist?
Not at all.
Do you want to get in touch with some people in Montreal who know how to burn things down?
I've thought about that. Yeah,
and there's so many options in the restaurant world.
A lot. Yeah.
Really, most of them hover around burning it down. But, you know.
It's hard to make that look real, though.
You're in LA. Anything is possible.
Oh, we had a fire here a couple
CGI.
Of months ago that started in the kitchen at
Playa Provisions?
Here in this kitchen, we had the firefighters break down our front door to put out a kitchen fire that ignited in the middle of the night.
Pilot light?
Night cleaners left a pan with a rubber handle over the grill, on a shelf over the grill, and then left the grill on full blast, and then the handle melted into the grill and ignited into flames, and then the Ansel system put it all out before the firefighters even got here. So
that's
it was
a fun
just
cleanup
it was
though
just,
after the Ansel
it
system.
It was a process, yeah. And then you have to have fire department clear you to reopen, and health department clear you to reopen.
Yeah, you
got to
recharge,
repaint everything. It was a process. But I don't wish for this place to burn down yet, because this is kind of my bread and butter.
No, it's more the 5-year plan. Basically, it's like what aspirational things you want to do. Your son's Hudson is how old now?
He's 11 and a half.
Right. It's amazing how quickly they grow. Beatrice and Clementine are 15 and 17, and within 2 years they'll be out of the house, which is
terrifying.
Crazy.
That's terrifying. They're so gorgeous.
They're good kids.
They're here. I got to meet them today, yep. And they're stunning.
They're good kids.
They really are. They make me grateful that I had a boy.
Yeah, they're easy. They're fun.
Yeah.
So
anyway,
yeah. What's next? Are you writing a book?
I just finished a proposal.
Okay.
So I will be shopping it. I'm trying to find the perfect agent right now to shop that proposal. It's my second proposal. The first one didn't sell, and I get why. And it just wasn't kind of to the point enough, and I wasn't super excited about it. So I think people wanted me to change it into a book about one of my restaurants or a book about me. And the thing about a book and why it's taken me so long to write one is because I want to be proud of something that I put out into the world, like a book, for more than a few years. And I think that if I were to write a book about one of my restaurants, it would be irrelevant in 10 years, because who knows where these restaurants will be in 10 years. So anyway, long story short, I have written a proposal, but I have not finished a book. I don't know. I feel like, where do I want to be in 10 years? Or 5 years. I want to, I don't know. I'm kind of doing what I always wanted to be doing. There's nothing poignant about what
and
I'm
that,
doing that I
you
haven't
know,
done.
But that's one of the most beautiful things in being a human, is being content with where you are now.
I am.
And that's great.
It's strange. People always ask me what
do you
next
want to do
step
next?
Is. I don't have a next step.
But I think that's what modern chefdom, that I think we're reassessing right now, but modern chefdom is you always have to be progressing towards something new.
Well, there is some validity to that, though. Because leases run out, people have a short attention spans, and
right.
If we're not continuously shifting and changing who we are to fit what the newest exciting thing is, we could become irrelevant. And we will become irrelevant at some point, probably.
Irrelevant for years. I was talking to Suzanne Goyen the other day, and she did have this beautiful line that she just said. That it was said in the middle of a paragraph of her talking about various things, but she just said, "I'm very happy with how things are."
Yeah,
and it's in a Zen-like way. That's a really pure thought.
Yeah.
My problem is my worldview is all-encompassing and keeps me up at night with anxieties, and I think things are fucked. But
I sleep.
Individually, I think I'm fine.
I haven't slept in years. And
you
I'm,
don't look but, it, Brooke. You look well-rested.
Thanks. I appreciate it. I actually didn't sleep at all last night. It was crazy. Anyway, but that's the
too much coffee story.
No, I'm on these like steroids to
bulk up.
Yeah. To bring down the swelling of an inner ear infection that was making me super dizzy. Oh. Which is a terrible feeling. But they don't allow me to sleep. But they also make me feel like I don't need sleep. So I'm just a mess right now. But
this is the latest episode of It's Not Easy Being Brooke.
However, but to sort of wrap up that thought, yes, I feel like I need to continue to find a next step. I'm kind of always, my husband and I are always looking at new opportunities, new leases, new prospects of maybe where to open another of the same or something completely different. It kind of depends on the location and the scenario, but there kind of always has to be a next step, right? Because we've chosen this industry that is forever changing and very rapidly. And
I mean, there always has to be a next step. At the same time, I mean, I want my aspirational side to be like, I'm going to read more books and take care of myself. And, you know, there's that, and there's the aspirations about being a chef and writing more books and opening more restaurants and doing more consulting. But it's like, and that's cool too, but mm-hmm. I don't know. There's got to be a synergy between the two, or it's just like,
yeah. And I put just as much emphasis, I think, on enjoying and living my life as I do on my businesses.
Yeah.
And I think that that's important. I think I've gotten to a point in my life where I feel like none of this is worth it if I can't enjoy it.
If you're not happy, and family's not happy with it,
yeah,
and things are good,
yeah.
Well, it's Saturday, Brooke. There's a whole Playa Vista out there. I'm going to go encounter it.
You're going to go Vista in?
I'm going to go Vista in. Okay. But thanks for having me at the restaurant and chatting about life.
Thanks for being
it's
here.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. High five.
High five.
I taped this episode of Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot on location at Playa Provisions in Playa Del Rey, California. You should go. Scott Porch produces the show, and Mackenzie Mazzill edited this episode. You can follow Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like what you hear, please rate and review and come back Tuesday for a new episode. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Hugh Atchison. That's H-U-G-H-A-C-H-E-S-O-N. Thanks for listening. Eat well, be swell.